speak about shared dynamics. Tim?
Okay, hello. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk in the Loop Quantum, in the International Loop Quantum Gravity Seminar on shape dynamics. And I will actually honor the theme of the seminar and talk at the end about a tentative loop quantization of shape dynamics. So before I start, people asked me yesterday what those two pictures on the front page mean. So that is, on the one hand, Hermann Minkowski, and on the other hand, Plato, representing the space-time picture, and a relational spatial picture, on the other hand, with Plato. Let's please go to slide 2. For those people who are interested in following up on what I talk about today, I put down a list of literature that you can follow up, and the only thing that I want to point out is that the last part of this talk will be on loop quantization of shape dynamics, and I just didn't manage to get that draft on the archive before the talk. I'm sorry about that. So let's go to slide number 3, the outline. So I want to give a generic introduction into shape dynamics. There are some technical steps that I will talk about first. That is symmetry trading, and then I will explicitly construct shape dynamics. Then I will address 4 objections that I myself developed during the construction of shape dynamics, and I will address my current answers to those. Those may not be final. Then I will go to the theme of the seminar and give a tentative question with loop quantum gravity. And then I want to summarize and basically give an invitation to so many open problems that can be addressed in shape dynamics. So let's please go to slide 4. What is shape dynamics? Well, the short answer is that shape dynamics is a formulation of GR, where foliation symmetry is traded for a spatial conformal symmetry. So what we do is we use the same phase space, we use the same description as Hamiltonian as the ADM formulation of GR, but we change the symmetry principle there. So the immediate question that you have there is, if it's just the reformulation of GR, why bother? And to me, the answer to that has at least 3 parts. One is the ontology of gravity. So if you have a different symmetry, then you have a different theory space, for example, for effective field theory. And that is a very similar theory space to Hershover-Lifshitz gravity. So just from that ontological point of view, that is something that is already interesting. The other thing is, you may have access to new aspects. So, I mean, all proofs are at the end just tautologies, but some tautologies become really apparent if you use a particular formulation, whereas they're hidden in the formalism and really hard to find out if you have a different formulation. I will give you one example, and that is a classical large CMC volume CFT correspondence between that is apparent in shape dynamics, that is kind of hidden in GR. And then, of course, for quantum gravity seminar, it's the hope that you can do something with quantum gravity for it. And if you have 2 different, classically equivalent, but off-shell different theories, then you may hope that that quantization gets stuck at different points and that you learn something new about quantizing gravity. And in fact, I will present very briefly an example that is Dirac quantization of metric gravity, so of basically the ADM formulation, but in the shape dynamics version of the 2+1 sphere and torus. Actually, I will go into detail only on the torus because that's the interesting piece. And I will show that while the Wheeler-DeWitt equation gets stuck at that point, the shape dynamics way of doing this, because we have linear constraints, doesn't get stuck. We can, in fact, straightforwardly quantize that and do something like and find equivalence with reduced phase-based quantization. So let's go to slide number 5. Everything I will talk about today will be in the canonical framework. So what all of you know is a canonical system. You have a phase space gamma, a Poisson bracket, you have a Hamiltonian, and you have first and second class constraints. Well, I assume that this is obtained through a to a singular genre transform of a consistent Lagrangian. So I really have just first and second class constraints, and I have no inconsistencies in my theory. But now, what you get, what the Legendre transform gives you, is just a constraint surface. It does not give you a particular form of the constraint. So the constraint surface is a geometric object. The particular form of the constraints are just coordinates for transverse directions to the constraint surface. So that is already something that I some people gloss over when they see constraint system. But for this reason, I will make some reasonable assumptions about the constraints, and they will be satisfied later on. I assume the constraints to be regular and an irreducible set of all first-class constraints. So that basically means that there are good coordinate functions for the transverse directions in an open neighborhood of the constraint surface. That excludes something like the master constraint, because that is obviously not a regular value. The zero is obviously not a regular value of the master constraint. And then there is the Dirac conjecture that says that all first-class secondary constraints generate gauge transmission. There are counterexamples. I put the canonical counterexample is on this slide. But for the purpose of this talk, I will just assume the Dirac conjecture to hold. And if you do that, then you have gauge freedom. You have these co-isotropic directions on the constraint surface, and you have to do, in order to have a definite evolution, in order to have definite trajectories, you have to employ a gauge fixing. So I assume that for each first class constraint, I have a gauge fixing condition, these are the sigma i's here, such that the Poisson bracket, this whole matrix of Poisson brackets of the first class constraints with the sigmas is invertible. That means basically that the first class constraints combined with the gauge fixing conditions are turned into second class constraints, and also if you choose them wisely, then they have unique solutions. You don't have a Gribov problem. And if you do that, if you have these gauge fixing conditions, then you can go to reduced phase space. This is, you said, you solve explicitly the second class constraints, you go explicitly to the surface where they all vanish, and then you work out the Dirac bracket, which is the induced form on the constraint surface. And so from now on, I will make two additional assumptions that are realized in gravity. I will first assume that I don't have a true Hamiltonian. If there was a true Hamiltonian, I would assume that it comes in the form of an energy conservation constraint, which is obviously first class, like in Jacobi's theory, and that all second class constraints have been solved. So I have already done phase space reduction if they came out of the Legendre transform. So with that being said, let's go to slide number 5. And that is the picture that how we obtain this symmetry trading, because I told you shape dynamics has a different set of symmetry principles. In that picture, if you start with theory B on the right-hand side, you see that it's defined on a phase space, and I just, to indicate the different phase spaces, I put in coordinate functions. So the Q's and P's are the coordinates in that phase space, and I have two disjoint sets of first-class constraints in theory B. And what I want to do is I want to prove equivalence with theory A. That is, on the same phase space with the same Poisson bracket, but with a different set of constraints. Basically, the chi1s in theory B are replaced by chi2s in theory A. To do that, I can employ a linking gauge theory on an extended phase space that has, now this extension is indicated that I have additional coordinates phi and pi. And of course, then I need more constraints, because the theories cannot be equivalent if I have more physical degrees of freedom. But with this extension, if the if the extension matches just up with the additional number of constraints, then you have reasonable hope that that works. In fact, now I will assume that the chi ones in the linking theory can be solved for the momenta conjugate to the phis, and the chi twos can be solved, so they're equivalent, to for the position variables in the extension. So I assume this particular form for the chi ones and chi twos in the extension. If I do that, then I can employ two partial gauge fixing conditions. And one is I employ the partial gauge fixing condition phi alpha equals zero, and the other one is pi alpha equals zero. I can then go to reduced phase space, and I can explicitly work it out. It is the phase space where the entire extension is annihilated, and phi and pi are respectively set to zero, and vice versa, pi is set to pi naught, and on the other side, phi is set to phi naught. So if I do that, then I also find that that both phase spaces, that the Dirac bracket that I get from this partial gauge fixing, coincides with the leads to the same Poisson bracket in theory A and theory B. Now, to prove equivalence, dynamical equivalence between theory A and theory B, I just have to impose another partial gauge fixing on theory A. I impose the pi alpha naught, and on theory B, I've imposed the phi alpha naught, and then I get to, and I do another phase space reduction, I get to a dictionary theory. And now this dictionary theory has the same initial value problem, has the same equations of motion on this reduced phase space. So I can explicitly show that up to a gauge transformation, theory A is equivalent to theory B. So now let's go to slide number 7, canonical best matching. That is the construction principle that we will use for constructing a linking gauge theory. And it's really, morally, it's inspired by Julian Barber's Markian ideas. And his idea, he conceptualizes in configuration space rather than in phase space. So his idea is that he wants to implement a symmetry in configuration space that is parameterized by some group parameters phi. And for now, I will just assume an abelian group. The non-abelian case is just slightly more complicated. So we have a first-class system, and we want to implement this symmetry. So basically, an invariance under little q and in the first box goes to big Q for an arbitrary value of phi. So the construction, how you can do that, is you first extend phase space basically by the cotangent bundle of this group. And then you get, of course, equivalence with the original phase space if you add, if you say the group is just pure gauge. So you just impose, for example, the pi alpha equals zero as a new set of first class constraints, because the original system was independent of phi and pi. These constraints are automatically first class. So now comes the crucial point. I do a canonical transformation. I wrote the generator F down here that for this canonical transformation. So that does something. So that basically takes the little q's into big q's, but it also does something to the extension, to the pi alphas. And what is important is that what was previously a trivial constraint, just pi alpha equals zero, goes after this canonical transformation into pi alpha minus pi alpha naught of q and p. And that is precisely of the form that I wanted on the one side of the linking theory in the previous slide. And moreover, the best matching condition that Julian Barber would call this the free endpoint variation is that the group is just pure gauge. That is a condition that you now have to impose, that the pi alphas are zero as an additional condition. Now, this condition may just Poisson commute with with the constraints on Hamiltonian in your system. And if that happens, then your original system had already this symmetry as a gauge invariance. It was just hidden, and you can just put that in. In the second case, and that is the case that we hope for, is that it gauge fixes all or at least a subset of the first class constraints of the original system. In this case, you can show that it's, that you lead to a linking theory like I described on the previous slide. And there's of course a third possibility that it generates secondary constraints, and then you have to go through the entire Dirac procedure and analyze this system in detail. And it's on the verge of becoming inconsistent there. So let's please go to slide number 8. That is what you, what all of you most likely already know about general relativity. I will just, I need the ADM formulation for the first part of this talk. So I assume global hyperbolicity, and for now I also assume that I have a compact Cauchy surface without boundary. The reason for that is boundary conditions are treatable in our formalism, but it's very cumbersome, and we have just worked out one example in detail, and I don't want to go through all that pain. So you have basically the ADM phase space has is coordinatized very well by the spatial metric and its conjugate momentum density. And then the theory is presented as a constrained Hamiltonian that is a linear combination of spatial diffeomorphisms. So for each spatial vector field, I have a diffeomorphism constraint and local refoliation constraints. So for each strictly positive N, I have a refoliation constraint. So now something that Enrique Gomez finds very suggestive is that the generic initial value problem and the generic regularity proof for these for this system of constraints is strictly proven in constant mean curvature gauge. So where the trace of pi is of the metric momentum is a spatial constant. There are a few extensions of this in the literature, but it's really that the mathematical formulation is always works best, to say the least, in the trace of pi equals constant formulation. That is what some people find very suggestive. Let's go to slide number 9, and now I want to construct a linking theory between general relativity and shape dynamics. So I will start with the ADM system, and I will do best matching with respect to volume-preserving conformal transformations. So what I mean with volume-preserving is that I allow conformal transformations to arbitrarily reshuffle spatial volume around in the Cauchy surface, but the total volume of the Cauchy surface is not allowed to change. The reason for that is because if I were to allow arbitrary conformal transformations, then I could solve all Hamilton constraints of GR with that, and I would end up with a theory that has frozen dynamics, and I don't want that. So I extend phase space by an auxiliary conformal factor, and it's canonically conjugate momentum density, and I use the best matching generating functional that I described before, that I denote down here, and I put on the conformal factor, I put a hat there. And that hat is really the projection onto the volume-preserving part of the conformal transformation. So if I now work out the canonical transformation that implements my best matching, then I get this, then the pi phi equals zero, the pure gauge constraint for the conformal factor, transforms into pi phi minus something that is the generator for volume-preserving conformal transformations. This pi minus mean of pi will generate conformal transformations that leave the total volume invariant. So now I impose the pure gauge condition that pi phi equals zero, then basically in this generator the pi phi part goes away and I'm left over with the generator of volume-preserving conformal transformations, and I work out the reduced phase space. The reduced phase space turns out to just be the ADM phase space, And the volume preserving condition leaves me one Hamilton constraint behind. And that allows me to have matching trajectories. So basically that general relativity in CMC gauge, in constant curvature gauge, has exactly the same trajectories as shape dynamics in ADM gauge, where ADM gauge means that I impose all those Hamilton constraints that are gauge fixed in CMC gauge as gauge fixing conditions on the shape dynamics side. So now I can describe shape dynamics on the ADM phase space with the ADM Poisson bracket, and it has a spatial diffeomorphism constraint as you know it. It has a local conformal constraint, as I just described, and it has a very complicated Hamiltonian. It's basically the ADM Hamiltonian with unit labs, but under the canonical transformation, and then you have to insert for phi the value that solves the an inhomogeneous version of the Lichnerowitz-Jörg equation that implements the volume preserving condition. So that is a non-local function, but that is what we get for shape dynamics. So let's please go to slide number 10, and I want to just summarize pure shape dynamics, and I want to first talk about trajectories. So if I look at whole space times, then in the canonical formulation that is encoded in the Dirac algebra of hypersurface deformations on the left-hand side, and what you observe here, the vector constraints, the diffeomorphism constraints, the H of xi's, they just furnish a representation of the Lie algebra of spatial vector fields. What is, however, complicated, and everybody of you knows that, of course, is the Poisson bracket between two scalar constraints on the ADM side, because that goes into a diffeomorphism constraint, but you need a structure function and it has a rather complicated form. On the right-hand side, I write the shape dynamics algebra, and that is very simple because conformal transformations acting at different points, they commute with one another, they commute with the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is also diffeomorphism invariant. And again, the spatial diffeomorphism constraints, they just furnish a representation of the Lie algebra of spatial vector fields. So what I've done here is I have traded this nonlinear set of refoliation constraints for linear constraints. These volume-preserving conformal transformations, they're linear in the momenta, and a non-local Hamiltonian. Well, that does imply a different theory space. This is the ontological reasoning, and that could have implications for quantum gravity. Now, let me also talk about the initial value problem. If I assume the Dirac conjecture, then all S of n's are constraints and are generators of pure gauge transformation. So in that case, a total gauge fixing would also mean that I fix one particular time slice. In that case, I can obviously not match trajectories, but I can lift the volume preserving condition, and then I can trade all S of n's for D of rho's, and now I have to do something. The solvability conditions for the Lichnerowitz-Jörg equation, the modified Lichnerowitz-Jörg equation that I have here, requires that it's not trace of pi, but trace of pi plus or minus some constant that I get solvability. So this would restore locality, but at the expense of frozen dynamics, because I have also fixed a particular time slice in that. So let's go to slide number 11. When we worked on that, I have developed four key objections, and I want to address all of those. The first is you don't have a space-time picture. Well, the answer to that is no. I mean, you can simply use test fields, minimally coupled test fields, as a clock and drop model, and you can recover space-time operation. You just prepare some states for this test field and observe how they evolve, and through the evolution you obtain the space-time. If you're a relationalist, then that's what you would do with GR anyways. You would use a clock and drop model to interpret GR. The real problem that it points to is the universality of recovered space-time, basically that all fields see the same space-time. And that is not a problem if you come from ADM and you just do this, go through that procedure that I described previously, because on the ADM side you can manifestly do that and then come there. But if you want to have a construction principle from shape dynamics that is independent of GR, then you run into that problem of the universality of the recovered space-time. A possible way out is something that is currently work in progress, and this goes under the name symmetry doubling. This is basically, if you use a BRST formulation of GR and shape dynamics, then it seems that you can impose both the shape dynamics and GR symmetries at the same time in that. This is currently work in progress, and I will come to that briefly in the outlook at the end. So let's please go to the next slide. I just told you you should recover space-time by coupling it to matter. So how do we couple?
Someone has a question.
How do we couple matter to shape dynamics? In fact, the construction turns out to be rather straightforward. You go precisely through the same program that I described before, just that you use as a starting point not pure gravity, but a gravity matter system. And you do the best matching with respect to volume preserving conformal transformations. And then you obtain shape dynamics straightforwardly surface space reduction. And by construction, we have equivalent of the GR matter system with the shape dynamics version of that. Well, the picture is not as straightforward because you have to answer which conformal weight you assign to matter. And there one finds a useful guiding principle, at least in gauge theories, and that is that the constraints should decouple from one another. You should be able to solve the Gauss constraints that you get for Young-Mills, for example. They should be independent of the auxiliary fields. And that is a useful guiding principle, and at least for the bosonic part of the standard model, there is a preferred solution, and this is to give conformal weight zero to all matter fields. So I write down the generating functional for the best matching transformation in between the second and third box, and you observe the first two summons, they're just what you do in pure gravity. It's just the generator in pure gravity, and the later parts where I add Young-Mills fields and Higgs multiplets and possibly more, actually, we explicitly omitted spin one-half matter in the paper because there were some inconsistencies in the literature, and we wanted to sort those out before we put that into writing. And it's a currently ongoing project to have them sorted out completely. But you see in the Young-Mills part and in the Higgs part, there you just have an identity transformation. This is the generating function for the identity transformation. The A's are the original gauge fields, and the E's are the calligraphy E's are the transformed momentum, the transformed electric fluxes, and so on. So it's really just the identity transformation for that part. And that's what I mean with conformal weight zero. So we obtain, through that construction, we obtain a shape dynamics matter system that has, again, a difficult total Hamiltonian on the shape dynamics side, but the generator for volume-preserving conformal transformations is just unaltered. It is exactly the same as the one you got in pure gravity. And what the nice thing about this conformal weight zero choice for matter is that the diffeomorphism constraints and all Gauss constraints and the rotation constraints in the Higgs sector and so on, that they just fall through. They are unaltered through that construction. Something that, again, some people found suggestive is that the restrictions on that now we find some restrictions on the trace of pi, and they come from the solvability conditions of the Dirichlet-Jorgensen equation. And that is when you have a cosmological constant present or a Higgs potential present, then there is an excluded range of values for the mean of trace pi. And that's basically the asymptotic value that the mean of trace pi gets in this spherical slicing of the Sitter space, for example. And this range between plus and minus that value is excluded by the solvability conditions there. So we find that suggestive, or some people find that suggestive, for the simple fact that those are the two parts of our current understanding of the universe that are not completely understood. So maybe there is some more to that story, but I don't know. That's just a simple observation. Let's please go to the next slide, number 13. There is objection two. It's just the York procedure. So in summary, yes, we use a lot of the same mathematics of the York procedure. We use a lot of theorems that were proved in the early to mid 70s. For the initial value problem, but our constructions and therefore the consequences of what we do are fundamentally different. And I want to point out three key differences. There are more subtle technical differences. So first, the York procedure concerns only the initial value problem. So they are concerned with decoupling of constraints and generating good initial data for GR. Whereas shape dynamics is concerned with the propagation of constraints. And that is the technical reason why our Hamiltonian, why the York Hamiltonian just needs to solve a lapse fixing equation, whereas our Hamiltonian needs the solution of a Lichnerowitz York equation. The second point is the volume preserving condition. This is not used in the initial value problem, but it is essential, as I showed before, to have equivalence between trajectories. And it's also what gives us the correct scaling, so we have solvability, so we have good solvability conditions for our equations. And the third point is that this best matching is a canonical transformation. This is the key part why we have equivalent trajectories, because if it wasn't a canonical transformation, we couldn't prove that the Poisson brackets coincide, so we couldn't prove that we have the same equations of motion. On the other hand, in the initial value problem, it's just the transverse traces decomposition of the momenta, and the conformal weights are assigned basically by hand, and they don't come out of a canonical transformation. So those are the key differences. Let's please go to slide number 14. The next objection is that our Hamiltonian is unmanageable. And the answer to that is yes, if you're pertaining that to all classical trajectories, to generic classical trajectories, that is true. But if we are in the classical realm, then we can impose ADM gauge. That is, we impose all those scalar constraints of ADM that are gauge fixed in CMC gauge. As gauge fixing conditions for the volume preserving conformal transformations. And in that case, the shape dynamics Hamiltonian is just the proper time Hamiltonian in ADM. So just with unit lapse. So that is a possible way out. So the answer to that part is, whenever you know how to deal with CMC gauge on the GR side, you're able to deal with that special gauge on the shape dynamic side, and it's just the same. You have the same technical complications. The other thing is, once you're interested in the generic initial value problem and the solution, you fix gauge on the ADM side anyways. And in that case, you have the same complications. You have to solve the Lichnerowitz-York equation for generic initial data, and then you have to do exactly the same as what we are doing. So for generic trajectories, it's for deparametrizing GR, for example, if you wanted to do that, you would have to do the same thing there too. Now I want to mention also that because we just have an existence proof, I want to give you three instances where the shape dynamics Hamiltonian can be constructed explicitly. One is in 2+1 dimensions and simple topologies, and I will go to that on the next slide in detail. The other is in the strong gravity limit, or more precisely, whenever spatial derivatives are negligible, because in that case the Schnirr-Wittig equation becomes algebraic and you can just solve for the shape dynamics Hamiltonian. And the third point is to do a perturbation theory around ADM initial data. And if you do that, then you're very close to cosmological perturbation theory, if you put that in. And that is actually currently work in progress. The zeros in first order fall through very straightforwardly, but the second order is interesting, and because our constraints are at the end linear in the momenta, we hope that we have something new to say about the second order, because we know the local gauge, and if we manage to find a good approximation for the Hamiltonian, a consistent approximation in the perturbation theory sense, then we may be able to say something new in that. But that is the second order is currently work in progress. So let's please go to the next slide, gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions. 2 plus 1 dimensions works always because of a trick. And the particular trick that is behind why ADM works is because you can use a particular decomposition of the metric. You decompose it into a conformal factor lambda, into a spatial diffeomorphism F, and into a reference metric that is parameterized by Teichmuller parameters tau, indicated here. And then that is mirrored by the transverse traces decomposition of the metric momentum. And if you solve the constraints in CMC gauge classically, you just find that GR reduces to dynamics in Teichmuller space. And that is a finite dimensional space. So also, the Lichtenberg-Wittig equation becomes an algebraic equation on the sphere, and by application of the maximum principle, it becomes solvable on a torus topology, and that's why it works on the sphere and the torus particularly well. So let's look at the torus, because the sphere doesn't have shape degrees of freedom. And when we construct shape dynamics on the torus, we find the standard diffeomorphism constraint. We find the volume preserving constraint, and then we find a shape dynamics Hamiltonian. And you see, this is just a version of a reduced phase space Hamiltonian, where we retain the volume dependence and the mean of trace pi dependence. So it's a timeless Hamiltonian. Usually what one does in 2 plus 1, one solves this Hamiltonian for the volume and then says, oh, d for d trace pi is equal to the Poisson bracket with that Hamiltonian when I solve that for the volume, the York Hamiltonian. But that's not what we do here. So now I can look at Dirac quantizing that system because I have linear constraints. So I found this morning when I looked at these slides again that there is a typo on this slide, and I will come to that in a second. Now we just replace pi ABs by IH bar delta for delta GAB. We assume an operator ordering that we just have the simple Poisson bracket vector fields generated. And we assume that we find a measure that is divergence-free under the where these vector fields are divergence-free. And then if you do that, then the linear constraints simply imply that the wave function depends only on the Teichmuller parameters. And here's the typo. It also depends on the volume, and there should be also tau 1, tau 2, comma v there. But then I can just go through what has been done in the early 80s in 2 plus 1, and I can quantize that and the straightforward quantization that is also compatible with large diffeomorphism, so with modular invariance, is what I wrote down here. So you can explicitly quantize that, and you can do Dirac quantization. So you can put all, you don't have to reduce, you don't have to classically reduce phase space and then quantize, but you can first quantize and then reduce phase space. So that is very different. So now you may ask, what do you do for higher genus, where you have a, where you have to solve a generic Lichnerowitz-Yerkes equation? And in 2 plus 1, the answer in 2 plus 1, the trajectories point to an answer. And that is, the trajectories go to an asymptotic shape, and you just have expansion if you have a positive cosmological constant. So now let's assume a positive cosmological constant, and we say the trajectory has already entered that regime where the volume dominates over all other physical degrees of freedom. In that case, an expansion in powers of the volume is a good expansion for the Hamiltonian, and you can then, by using just the equations that define shape dynamics, expand the shape dynamics Hamiltonian, and you find the answer. The leading order is just mean of trace pi minus 4 lambda in two dimensions, mean of trace pi squared minus 4 lambda in two dimensions. Four dimensions, you get 12 lambda at that point, plus lower orders. The thing is, this expansion works also in higher dimensions. Whenever you enter this regime, that the volume, the total three volume, the total CMC volume dominates over all other physical degrees of freedom, then you can do this expansion. Or you can just not worry that that's a good physical expansion. You can just do the expansion if you want. But if you do this expansion, then you get a generic correspondence between large CMC volume and conformal theory, at least at the classical level, and that is because the leading order here just says that the one part of the conformal transformation that I had to take out explicitly to construct shape dynamics is now all, which is the total expansion, the redshift, that becomes also just pure gauge. So I have a complete conformal symmetry, and this is what we call large CMC volume CFT correspondence. Let's please go to slide number 16. My last objection is, well, there are non-CMC solutions to Einstein's equations, or there are boundaries to, say, if you set some asymptotic conditions to CMC. And what do you have to say about that? Well, the answer as of now is, this is really a restriction compared to GR, but it's a similar restriction like when you put in global hyperbolicity. You exclude something like a Gödel universe there. However, what I also mentioned before is that boundaries are in principle treatable in our formalism, and that is on our list of future projects. And in particular, if we can put in dynamical boundaries, and if that works with our formalism, then we can possibly circumvent some of these restrictions, and we can possibly say something about these non-CMC solutions, how we can treat them in shape dynamics. So that was the first part. Let's go to the loop quantization. So for that we need, there is slide 17, for that we need shape dynamics in Ashtika variable. And there is this, in the first box, I just outlined my roadmap, how to do that. Well, first you go from metric variables to triad variables. Then you transform them into extrinsic curvature variables, and then you do another canonical transformation, and you go to Ashtika variables. So if you go to triad variables, then you added an additional internal rotational degree of freedom, so you get an internal rotation constraint. But the best matching generator is just straightforward. You just observe that the triads have to have conformal weight 2 if the metric had conformal weight 4, and you put that in. And you work everything out. You find the linear constraints are against spatial diffeomorphisms, volume-preserving conformal transformations, and that the g of lambda, the rotation constraints, that they are unaltered through that construction. And basically, the Hamiltonian is just is the same shape dynamic Hamiltonian that we had before, just rewritten in triad variables. Then you go to extrinsic curvature variables. There are no surprises happen at that point, and then you do this canonical transformation to Ashika variables. And here I want to point out that I use a slightly different notation of a slightly different version of the electric fields, the flux fields in the Ashika variables, because I want to have an explicit canonical transformation. I don't want that the right-hand side of the Poisson bracket depends on the Mirzi parameter here. But I can do that, and then the rotation constraint turns into the Gauss constraint. That Gauss constraint is completely falls through, and also the diffeomorphism constraint is unaltered. But what is now happening is that the conformal constraint, that wants to be expressed in terms of extrinsic curvature. It doesn't like the Ashika variables very much. So if I were to write that in terms of KIA rather than A and the spin connection, then I would get a simple expression, but here I get something that is nonlinear in the flux fields, in the electric fields E. And that is a complication, and this is why I cannot do anything rigorous on the quantization part of that, but why I have to resort to something very heuristic, and that's why I call this whole section tentative loop quantization. Yeah. And then the Hamiltonian is, again, a non-local Hamiltonian, and in this case, just on the classical side, I retain the part that is proportional to the Gauss constraint in the Ashika Hamiltonian, which is usually thrown away, but I retain that here for the simple purpose in that case I'm able to calculate Poisson brackets off shell with the trick. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Now, number 18, kinematic loop quantization. So basically, I go to the nice work of, I hope many people in the audience have done that 15, 20 years ago. And basically for the kinematic part, I can do everything that has been done in loop quantum gravity. So in particular, if I go through the entire construction, I find that there is a dense orthogonal set for the gauge variant Hilbert space that is just given by the Peter Weyl decomposition of the holonomies, of products of holonomy states. So basically matrix elements of representations of holonomies of the Ashika connection. Then the holonomy matrix elements act as multiplication operators, fluxes through surfaces, they act as particular derivations on that space, and this is all standard. And then you can basically employ the same techniques that were employed in loop that were used in loop quantum gravity for the Gaussian diffeomorphism constraint, and you get the answer that the kinematic Hilbert space after you solve these constraints are labeled by gauge invariant Binot functions. So now I have this problem. I told you that the volume preserving conformal transformations or any kind of conformal transformations have this unmanageable form in Ashika variables. And it turns out, in fact, that they don't even close on spin network functions. So if I try to apply one of these transformations to a spin network function, then the right-hand side cannot be expressed in terms of spin network functions. So that is a big problem, and this is why I have to resort to something more heuristic. So the fluxes, I can explicitly calculate what they transform like, because I know how the E-fields, the densitized inverse triads, transform. They just transform with conformal weight 4. And so I can explicitly work out observables calculated from the triads that are gauge invariant. This is the total volume, of course, because that is the restriction that I put on my conformal transformations, that and all gauge invariant ratios, basically the angle variables, are invariant, are invariants of this construction, but all other observables that I can construct that are not dependent on that are pure gauge. In particular, any area is pure gauge, any non-vanishing area. Vanishing area is not pure gauge, but any non-vanishing area is pure gauge, so can arbitrarily rescale. But if I multiply zero by something, I still get zero. This is why I have to put non-vanishing there. So let's go to the next slide. I have a disclaimer here, and the warning is basically that I do something very heuristic on the next slide. In particular, I will treat the conformal transformations very heuristically, and I cannot quantize the shape dynamics Hamiltonian, but what I can do is I can fix an asymptotic slice and use the asymptotic shape dynamics Hamiltonian there, because that's, again, a simple thing. And these are two main critical points there that I wanted to just point out. Let's go to slide number 20. So the heuristic implementation of the volume-preserving conformal transformations is, well, choose a recoupling basis. Then you have then at each vertex you have a maximal commuting set of angle observables, of independent angle observables. And then you can determine a spin network function uniquely by area eigenvalues and by these angle eigenvalues. Basically, the area eigenvalues give you the representations on the edges, and the angle eigenvalues combined with the adjacent area give you the intertwiner structure at the node. And then, of course, I have to keep the total volume as an additional quantum number. So now I observe the areas are pure gauge, so a non-vanishing area, I just choose a unique representative for this non-vanishing area. And then I say, okay, now my basis that was previously gauge invariant spin network functions are now labeled by a graph and in this particular recoupling basis by a maximal set of independent angle observables and, of course, by the total volume. So now the question is, how can I quantize the shape dynamics on the, and I don't have an answer to that. That's why I put three question marks rather than one at this point. Well, but if you assume the Dirac conjecture, then all scalar constraints of ADM or Ashtekar are just pure gauge. So if I did a complete gauge fix and a complete symmetry trading, I would not match up trajectories, but I would also fix one particular time slice. If I do that, then I can trade the shape dynamics Hamiltonian for something that is of the form mean of trace pi minus something that is proportional to the volume. As I pointed out before, I need this alpha here because of the solvability condition of the Lichnerowitz-York equation. After a canonical transformation, I can put that into the form, at least classically, I can put that into the form of mean of trace pi. So if I now mod out also these last conformal transformations, I use the total volume as the label of my basis. And so my basis is now labeled by a knot class and by a maximal independent set of angle eigenvalues. Well, one problem that is obvious in this approach is, can I get rid of the recoupling choice that I had to do at the beginning of this construction? And I don't know. It will depend on particular scaling properties of the recoupling. And I really don't know about that. So let's please go to the next slide. I give a questionable interpretation. I mean, it's by no means that I claim that this has anything to do with physics, but the obvious objection is when I treat, besides that I use this non-standard treatment of the conformal transformations, where is the equivalence with CMC dynamics that I have in shape dynamics?
Well, if I use the large CMC volume correspondence, I assume a positive cosmological constant, and suitable initial data, then I have this asymptotic expansion. So I use this asymptotic expansion, and the leading order just tells me 12 lambda minus mean of trace pi squared is the shape, is the leading order of the shape dynamics of Hamiltonian, which becomes exact if the volume goes to infinity. So that is now classically equivalent to mean of trace pi is some number, and that is, and so the questionable interpretation that I can put on that is, well, the states in the mutual constraint kernel, they just describe asymptotic shapes of the universe in the very large volume limit. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's definitely something that comes out if you assume, if you make all these assumptions that I made before. Okay, let's go to the summary. So I want to highlight some of the features. I want to recap some of the features of shape dynamics. So shape dynamics arises from trading refoliation invariants for local spatial conformal invariants. The construction principle that I have, this linking theory and this canonical best matching, that is a very general mechanism for symmetry trading. It's not generic that it works, but the mechanism, the formalism can be applied very generically. Then the existence theorems that were used for the initial value problem of GR are precisely those things, those mathematical ingredients that ensure that shape dynamics exists. And then I showed you that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, one can actually do something new. One can construct shape dynamics explicitly and run, and if one does Dirac quantization, one can do Dirac quantization rather than reduced phase space quantization in metric variables, whereas that doesn't work in because the Wheeler-DeWitt equation already on the sphere is unmanageable. And then we get, then I showed you also on the, with this large volume expansion, that generically one has a large CMC volume correspondence with classically just conformally invariant theories. I showed you that this, at least when one restricts oneself to bosonic matter, that works with standard matter content, and that the space-time picture, once you have matter, can be recovered operationally. That is straightforward. And then I gave you a very tentative loop quantization. So let's go to the last slide where I give an outlook. So I promised you that there is a current project that we call symmetry doubling, and it's based on the observation that in the BRST formalism you can choose a very special gauge fixed Hamiltonian, and that is invariant under two BRST transformations generated by some original something that you would get originally, plus the dual, where the dual would be the shape dynamics symmetry. And that is reminiscent of anti-BRST invariants, but it is not equivalent. It is something different. And here, the complete symmetry trading, so that I trade all of the ADM constraints for conformal constraints is admissible, and this means that formalism is local. And this is why we have hoped that we have something to say with this with the BRST formalism. And just to give you a flavor that there are many open projects, I listed a couple of examples. For example, we want to understand, we have this symmetry trading and symmetry doubling, we have that in a coordinate language, but we would like to understand the symplectic geometry. We would also, like I pointed out, we would also like to understand how to treat boundaries and isolated horizons, for example, in our formalism. And more advanced would be dynamical boundaries and possibly be able to say something that is non-CMC foliable. Then I told you that it's currently work in progress to do higher orders in perturbation theory. And also, just something that is straightforward is to explore to explore the gauge freedom in shape dynamics. So take GR solutions, CMC foldable GR solutions, and do volume-preserving conformal transformations to them, and explore the structure that these solutions have when once you use that gauge symmetry. And that is a completely open project. And then, of course, the symmetry dating or symmetry doubling can be applied to other theories people have mentioned to me so far. Young Mills, we have not done that, but we have looked at electromagnetism. Other people have tentatively suggested to do something with fluid dynamics. So this seems to be a very widely applicable formalism, and which is not related to shape dynamics, but to the underlying formalism. So to go to the very last slide, I want to thank you for your attention.
Questions?
A simple question from SA. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
The simple question is there a Lagrangian version of all this? The covariant in the usual sense?
No, we do not have a Lagrangian version where we eliminate the auxiliary phi field. If you retain that, then it's... then you have a Lagrangian version, but we do not have a Lagrangian version without that.
And is that local if you retain this field?
If you retain that, then you're still local.
Okay. Is there anything to be learned by applying this in the context of cosmologies? Or is it everything trivializes?
Well, what we hope with cosmology is not in the realm of homogeneous cosmology, but if you go beyond homogeneous cosmology, if you do perturbation theory, we have to hope that because our constraints are linear in the momenta, so to find physical degrees of freedom seems to be simpler. And you know, in cosmology, you have that problem once you go to second order in perturbation theory that you have to solve nonlinear constraints. And if we get our Hamiltonian into a manageable form in a perturbative expansion that is adapted to cosmology, then we can possibly say something about physical degrees of freedom, something new.
So, but in the homogeneous case, I assume you can choose variables such that all the constraints are gone, but that global constraint is still going to be there, right?
Yes. If you do the symmetry reduction to homogeneous cosmology, then you basically end up classically with the same equations that you had before.
Ah, okay.
Because the homogeneity, you just apply the maximum principle to the Lichtenherz-Jörg equation. The conformal transformation has to be also homogeneous, and because of the volume-preserving condition in the compact case, at least, you don't gain anything new. In the non-compact case, you also, because there you have to set boundary conditions. We have just done that for asymptotically flat so far, and in the asymptotically flat, the boundary conditions completely determine the conformal factor inside once you assume homogeneity, and so you don't learn anything new there either.
Thanks. More questions? Yeah, Bai had a question in the middle of the talk.
I mean, when I look at the framework, I mean, this is something that was looked at, this kind of thing were looked at early days, right? I mean, this is because Lichtenherz-Jörg equations were very, in fact, the whole phase space formulation in terms of that was looked at by Kusturud and me, for example, quite a long time ago. And I mean, we sort of found that the unmanageability of the Hamiltonian constraint is what makes the problem, you know, very difficult in quantum theory. Now, here, I agree that you can do it in the 2 plus 1 setting, but as you said, for this torus and the sphere, this was already done by Moncrief using exactly the Stieg-Müller spaces. And of course,
it's true is that what Moncrief's work is, he imposed classically the CMC condition, and then he worked out the reduced phase space, and then he was able to quantize that system. So what I claim, what we did new is that we did not have to do this this phase space reduction at the classical level.
I know. So that's what I'm coming to, right? Exactly. So the statement is that you don't have to do that, but the places where the procedure is successful are the places where it was successful by doing that kind of phase space reduction by just using trace k equal to constant slices and so on. So I'm a little bit confused about. I mean, it's true that the viewpoint is different and so on, but I'm still a little bit confused about how the main problems that were there with this whole, with York equation and adding the confounding factor degree of freedom, which really had to do with the unmanageability of the Hamiltonian constraint. I just don't see that as being kind of even qualitatively being addressed. I mean, that is my basic confusion.
Okay, I can share that concern, and this is why in the outlook, why I pointed now into a different direction with the quantum theory, and that is we want to explore the BRST extension. In that case, there is nothing wrong with trading all, with basically using all of trace pi as a gauge fixing condition, so do the complete CMC gauge fixing. And in that case, it still seems that the quantum theory may, that first the classical BRST formulation has an additional invariance, and it's still local. So our best hope right now is to do that, to explore that direction, but that is currently work in progress. And we may be able, in a month or two, to have preliminary results on that and tell you something new there. The other point is, what could also be a hope, is not to do full quantum gravity, but to do cosmological perturbation theory. And then I go back to some questions back, that we may have something to say once we get our Hamiltonian under control for a second order, we may have something to say about physical degrees of freedom in that case. So those are, so I agree that that straightforwardly quantizing what I presented in the main part of the talk, the shape dynamics, is obstructed by this non-locality of the Hamiltonian, and I don't know a better solution, a satisfactory ansatz for that.
More questions? Okay, let's thank them again.